Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Stepbrother of Kimberly Ratliff pleads not guilty to murder, February 2nd jury trial scheduled. A jury trial has been scheduled for a Bluffs native accused of murdering his stepsister, Kimberly Ratliff, in January 1999. On December 18th, court records show that Jill Eimerman, an attorney representing the defense unit of the state of Iowa's Public Defender's Office, filed a written not guilty plea on behalf of Matt W. Kennedy in Pottawatomie County Court. As a result, his case has jumped to Pottawatomie County District Court, where he is scheduled for a February 2nd jury trial, court records show. He is currently being held in Pottawatomie County Jail on a $1 million bond. On the morning of January 12, 1999, Ratliff was discovered inside her white 1988 Plymouth Sundance, which had been abandoned in the 1400 block of West Broadway. After being missed for about 3.5 days, the 22-year-old's body was found by a Peoples Natural Gas employee who was clearing snow from the sidewalk bordering the business's Council Bluffs office, according to the Omaha World Herald Archives. Ratliff's body was found sprawled across the front seat, her throat slashed, according to archive reports. She was last seen alive when she got off work at Airlight Plastic Company, an Omaha business, around 11:30 on a Friday evening. Her mother, Joyce Kennedy, and the defendant both worked for the company at the time as well. Kennedy, 52, was arrested in mid-October after advancements in DNA technology enabled Council Bluffs police to link him to the homicide, according to an arrest affidavit. Items collected from the original crime scene were submitted in 2014 to the Iowa State DCI Laboratory for evaluation. In 2017, the lab informed local law enforcement that an unknown male DNA profile was discovered on one of the items. The item, court records show, was of personal nature to Ratliff, that only she and the suspect would have been in contact with. Included in the list was Kennedy, who was the last known person to see Ratliff alive, according to the affidavit. In late August, known DNA samples of 6 men were submitted to the DCI lab for comparison to the unknown male DNA profile. On September 15th, the department determined the unknown DNA profile was consistent with Kennedy. On September 25th, court records show additional items of evidence were submitted to the University of Nebraska Medical Center Human DNA Identification Laboratory for testing. On October 7th, police learned additional DNA was found on a second item in a location the suspect likely would have touched during the assault on Ratliff. DNA results led to an elimination of a second male subject, leaving Kennedy as the remaining suspect, according to the affidavit. Eimerman and Pottawatomie County Attorney Matt Wilbur weren't immediately available for comment Monday afternoon. Next article. Connections to offer free caregiver class. Connections Area Agency will offer a free evidence-based virtual class for caregivers this winter. Powerful Tools for Family Caregivers will be held weekly for 6 weeks via Zoom for caregivers of adults with chronic conditions, according to a press release from Connections. Enrollees can tap in from 1:30 to 3 o'clock or from 6:30 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday from January 12th through February 16th. Participants will need a laptop or computer with camera and microphone. The class is designed to provide caregivers with tools and strategies to better handle the unique challenges they face. The press release stated, caregiving may include helping a friend or relative with transportation, housekeeping, grocery shopping, personal care, medications, emotional support, or doctor's appointments. Class size is limited. Registration is required by January 4th to order materials. The caregiver help book and handouts will be mailed. There is no cost for the program, but there will be an opportunity to donate. For more information, contact Jan Schnack, Family Caregiver Specialist at Connections at jschnack@connectionsaaa.org or 1-800-432-9209. Next article. Council Bluffs man killed in Omaha head-on collision. A Council Bluffs man was killed in a collision at 1:30 a.m. Sunday on I-480 in Omaha. Ray A. Sutton, 42, was southbound on I-480 just north of Leavenworth when his 2007 Chevy Malibu was struck almost head-on by a 2016 Lincoln MKZ traveling northbound in the southbound lanes and driven by Joshua M. Seaman, 23, of Omaha, according to a press release from the Omaha Police Department. Sutton was pronounced dead at the scene by Omaha Fire Department medics. Seaman was transported by medics to Nebraska Medical, where he was listed in critical condition Monday morning, according to police. The southbound lanes of I-480 were closed until 5:30 a.m. Sunday. An investigation into the crash continues. Next article. Keg Creek Brewing takes two medals at Beer U.S. Open. A Glenwood brewery recently had two of its creations recognized during a national competition. Established in 2011, Keg Creek Brewing Company President Randy Romans noted that various beers from the company have fared well in prestigious competitions. However, this was the first year he and his business partners, Art Renzi, John Bultel, and Matt Kirch, participated in the U.S. Open Beer Championship. And the company excelled. Two of its eight submissions were awarded bronze medals in their respective categories. Entries for this year's competition ran deep, according to information from the U.S. Open Beer Championship website, with more than 6,000 beers entered representing more than 140 different styles. Due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, judging was held in both the U.S. and Canada at locations including Atlanta, Georgia, Oxford, Ohio, and Welland, Ontario. Judging in the U.S. Open Beer Championship is blind. Judges know only the categories, not the names or locations of beers being judged, according to information provided by Romans. It made us feel really good, he said, of the achievement, praising head brewer Mitch John Jr. Anytime you get people that are experts in the field and they identify your beer as being really, really good, it's great. Of course, we think they are good, but it's nice to have someone else tell you that also, and then to have the hardware to go with it. The bronze finishers, Roman said, were Deviant of the Depths in the rum barrel aged beer category and Old Marathon in the barrel aged barley wine category, with both containing alcohol by volume of more than 10%. Romans noted that these particular selections sport a little more kick than standard domestics like a Bud Light or Coors Light. They are definitely sippers. Neither one you would want to chug, he said with a laugh. Currently, Roman said that Keg Creek distributes throughout Iowa and Nebraska. However, a push is being made to make a footprint in Northwest Missouri next. The brewery distributes 8 canned beer varieties and has up to 20 brews available in its tap room. The brewery, 22381 221st Street in Glenwood, is open from 4 to 10 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday, 3 to 11 p.m. Friday, noon to 11 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 6 p.m. Sunday. It's closed on Mondays. Romans said he's proud of the company's development and expansion since its inception, and none of it would have happened without processing the love for engineering new beers, something turned hobby to career. We thought we would take a chance and started off with a 3-barrel system and started doing our own tap room. And really, it just grew from there. Next story. First doses of vaccine set to arrive in Pottawatomie County today. The first doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine are set to arrive in Council Bluffs, according to Pottawatomie County Public Health. The two Council Bluffs hospitals and All Care Health Center, one of the county's 2 test Iowa sites, are set to receive vaccines directly for healthcare employees, Public Health Director Matt Wyant said. The county will receive its first shipment and set up its distribution clinic at the Mid-American Center today, ahead of the first vaccines on Wednesday for first responders with the Council Bluffs Fire Department and volunteer departments throughout the county. The county clinic will also vaccinate to some healthcare workers from small clinics. The FBI's Omaha field office has issued a warning about potential COVID-19 vaccine scams. In guidance with the FBI, U.S. Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, residents are advised that the following are scam warning signs. You are asked to pay out of pocket to get the vaccine. You are asked to pay to put your name on a vaccine wait list or to get early access. Advertisements for vaccines through social media platforms, email, telephone calls, online, or from unsolicited, unknown sources. Marketers offering to sell or ship doses of vaccine for payment. Anyone who believes they've been a victim of fraud can report it at 1-800-HHS-TIPS or 1-800-CALL-FBI or 1-800-MEDICARE. Iowans are heading into the winter holidays with few restrictions on gathering or social activities despite significant numbers of recent COVID-19 deaths and hospitalizations in the state. The state health department on Monday reported 600 new confirmed cases of the disease caused by the COVID coronavirus, but no new deaths from it, though fewer tests were conducted in the past few days, and there was a delay in the reporting of deaths. The state reported 138 deaths on Sunday after listing none in the 2 previous days. Public health officials revised the state's method of calculating deaths earlier this month and said the new system would likely delay the reporting of COVID-19 deaths by up to a week. The 7-day rolling average of daily deaths in Iowa has risen slightly, from nearly 44 per day in the 2 weeks that ended December 5th to nearly 46 per day during the 2 weeks that ended December 19, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. Iowa has had 3,589 deaths from the virus. On Monday, 644 people were hospitalized and 142 were in intensive care units. The number of long-term care facilities with outbreaks remained persistently high at 142. Governor Ken Reynolds last week lifted hours of operation restrictions on bars and restaurants and eased the limits on crowd gatherings and attendance at sporting events. She is encouraging Iowans to celebrate the upcoming holidays in small groups to avoid a virus resurgence. Dr. Megan Srivas, the infectious disease doctor who lives in Iowa and is a faculty member at the University of North Carolina, said viral activity in Iowa seems lower because testing has fallen off significantly. She said deaths and hospitalizations are a better sign that virus activity remains too high in the state. Srivas also said that because many Iowa children are attending school online until recently, virus activity slowed. But with nearly all districts returning to in-person learning, that and the holiday gatherings will likely help the virus spread, she said. Savannah also said the idea that the vaccine is just around the corner may lead many to relax their guard, but most people won't be able to get vaccinated until well into next year, she said. She also said that people don't understand that the vaccine generally prevents someone from getting very sick from the virus. Vaccinated individuals can still get the virus and spread it to others, so wearing masks and distancing will still be important for quite a while. Next story. Age not a factor for now in getting the job done for Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, says. Like a lot of older Americans, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley is working past the typical retirement age. In just the past two decades, the share of American workforce that is age 55 and above has grown from just 13% to 23% today, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Not only does Grassley illustrate that trend, he's leaving open the possibility he will try to hang on to his job even longer after his term ends in 2023. Age will be a factor in deciding whether to run again, Grassley said last week. He would be 95 if he completes an eighth term. That would make him the oldest person in the Senate since South Carolina's Strom Thurmond, who turned 100 in 2002, just before retiring. I mean, I'm 87, and if age is a factor, it would be a factor right now, Grassley said. That's what's more of a factor is my ability to do the job. As far as he is concerned, that's not in question. I'm working just as hard now as I did when I was 40 years ago, said Grassley, who in addition to being one of 100 senators, also is president pro tem of the Senate and chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. There are 7 octogenarians currently serving in the Senate. Grassley and California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, also 87, are the oldest. Feinstein added fuel to the how old is too old discussion when she announced she would step down as the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Grassley, who has served on judiciary since arriving in the Senate in 1981, plans to take another turn as his chairman in 2021 if Republicans retain the Senate majority. 2 of their 80-plus colleagues did not seek re-election this year. Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander recently told the Washington Post that Senate octogenarians face the age question and whether it's time to exit. He told the Post he did not want to stay too long. Kansas Republican Senator Pat Roberts also cited maturity in his decision. Grassley jokes that as long as he's able to run 2 miles 6 days a week, he's capable of doing the job. Even contracting COVID-19 didn't stop the Butler County farmer from daily runs. According to his office, Grassley ran for 13 straight days during his asymptomatic bout of COVID-19. However, Grassley acknowledges that he won't be able to run forever, either on foot or on the campaign trail. While campaigning for other Republicans back in 2018, Grassley said he felt he could live to 100. But that's not real life, he said when asked about his 2022 re-election plans. If anyone had asked 6 years earlier, he wouldn't have hesitated to say he would run for an eighth term. But then he added, "Why don't you ask me in September of 2021? Because I need to be able to know that I can get through until I'm 95. He doesn't want to serve if he's not healthy enough to do the job, both he and Iowans expect, Grassley said, suggesting he's seen colleagues stay in Washington too long. So he plans to make his decision by the middle of 2021. He's being encouraged by Republicans in Iowa and the Senate to run again. Democrats expect he will run again. Privately, some experts expect he will retire after being reelected so his grandson, Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, could be appointed to serve until the next general election. That would give the younger Grassley a running start on being elected in 2028. Of course, that scenario depends on a Republican being in the governor's office if Senator Grassley steps down. The elder Grassley has laughed at the suggestion he's grooming his grandson to succeed him. "You can't groom anybody to run for anything," he said earlier this year. "And it would be inappropriate for him to choose his own successor," he added. So far, Grassley hasn't given any signs of letting up. He just announced he's looking forward to his annual meetings in all of Iowa's 99 counties again in 2021. "This annual tradition keeps me in touch with the grassroots of Iowa and allows me to bring their ideas to the policy-making tables in Washington," he said. Besides, he added, "I love my work." During crucial holiday season, U.S. consumer confidence slumps. Silver Springs, Maryland. A closely watched gauge of U.S. consumer confidence tumbled in December as rising coronavirus cases dragged American optimism to its lowest levels since the summer. However, rising pessimism is now spreading during the crucial holiday season, which could make or break a number of retailers, airlines, restaurants, other sectors that have been hammered financially because during the pandemic. The December reading of 88.6 released Tuesday by the Conference Board is a sharp decline from last month, which was revised downward to 92.9% and is far worse than economists had expected. It may be an ominous sign of an economy in which consumer spending accounts for 70% of all economic activity. The Commerce Department reported last week that U.S. retail sales fell a seasonally adjusted 1.1% in November, the biggest drop in 7 months, and also worse than most were expecting. The drumbeat of weak economic data may be providing a grim preview of Christmas receipts, which can account for a quarter or more of retailers' annual sales. The index measuring consumer assessment of current business and labor market conditions also fell sharply from 105.9 last month to 90.3 in December. Consumers' short-term outlook for income, business, and labor market conditions ticked up slightly from 84.3 in November to 87.5 this month, possibly because of recent approvals for the COVID-19 vaccines. It remains to be seen how Congress's $900 billion relief bill, which was passed Monday and is too late for the survey, will affect consumer behavior this winter. The bill combines coronavirus fighting funds with financial relief for individuals and businesses. It would establish a temporary $300 per week supplemental jobless benefit and a $600 direct stimulus payment to most Americans, along with a new round of subsidies for hard-hit businesses, restaurants, and theater, and money for schools, health care providers, and renters facing eviction. Next article. Stocks drift after stimulus deal as virus worries still loom. Stocks are drifting in mixed trading on Wall Street Tuesday after Congress finally approved a $900 billion rescue to carry the economy through what's likely to be a bleak winter. The S&P 500 was virtually unchanged after the first 15 minutes of trading, a day after worries about a new, potentially more infectious strain of the coronavirus dragged markets through tumultuous trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 98 points, or 3%, at 30,117 as of 9:45 a.m. Eastern Time, and the NASDAQ composite was 0.5% higher. After months of big Congress approved a deal on Monday night to send $600 cash payments to most Americans, give $300 per week to laid-off workers, and deliver other aid to businesses struggling under the weight of the pandemic. The bill is going to President Donald Trump's desk for his signature. The hope for investors is that such support can prop up the economy for the next several months before a more widespread rollout of the coronavirus vaccines can allow it to stand on its own. That expectation has been driving markets for a while, but a new worry is casting some doubt on it. A new strain of coronavirus has emerged, one that is spreading quickly in London and southern England. There's no evidence that it's more deadly, but it seems to infect more easily. Worries are high enough about it that countries around the world have restricted flights from London, raising concerns that economy-punishing lockdowns may be on the way. Ireland is tightening coronavirus restrictions in response to rising infection rates, and it's proceeding on the assumption that the new strain is already in the country, for example. Helping to keep the worries in check was the CEO of BioNTech, the German company that developed a coronavirus vaccine with Pfizer. Ugur Sahin said it is highly likely that his company's vaccine can protect against the new variant, though further studies are needed to be sure. The United States has already approved the company's vaccine for use, and the European Union recently followed suit. Even without the new strain, worries were already high about rising coronavirus counts and deaths in countries around the world. The worsening pandemic has helped cause U.S. weekly unemployment claims to start rising again and sales at retailers to drop. That caused momentum to slow for the stock market, which set record highs last week after earlier surging on the hopes that COVID-19 vaccines will trigger a return to normal for the economy next year and that Washington would approve big stimulus to tide the economy over until then. In overseas stock markets, European indexes regained some of their sharp drops from the day before. France's CAC 40 rose 1%, and Germany's DAX returned 1%. The FTSE 100 in London added 0.3%. Shares retreated in Asia after the U.S. Commerce Department announced It was including 103 entities on a new military end-user list, including 58 Chinese and 45 Russian companies. Such a designation requires special licensing for exports and other sales of designated products to the listed companies to prevent certain technologies from being used by foreign militaries in China, Russia, or Venezuela, it said. Many of the companies are related to aviation and shipbuilding. The list adds to strains between Washington and Beijing, which already are feuding over technology, security, and other issues. Stocks in Shanghai lost 1.9%, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell 0.7%. Tokyo's Nikkei 225 dropped 1%, and South Korea's Kospi declined 1.6%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury slipped to 0.92% from 0.93% late Monday. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service of the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Esther Rocha, R-O-C-H-A, age 71, passed away December 21, 2020 in Omaha. Esther was born June 30, 1949 in Council Bluffs to the late David A. and Mary Vargas Negrete. Esther formerly worked at Oriental Trading Company. She is preceded by her parents and sister, Teresa Cooper. Survivors include daughter Brenda Rocha, Council Bluffs, sons Todd and Brian Rocha, both of Omaha, 9 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, siblings Margaret Diaz, Ramona Seinhoff, Jeannie Drumheller, Rose Sales, Tony Emmons, Tina, husband Rich Lyons, David, Carlos, wife Holly, Bob, wife Linda Negrete, brother-in-law Jim Cooper, nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family Wednesday, 6 to 9 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill, Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Please wear masks. Michael Dean West, age 76, passed away December 20, 2020 in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Michael was born July 20, 1944 in Council Bluffs to late George and Wanda West, Sr. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Army during Vietnam and was a tank commander. Michael was a former member of the Missouri Valley VFW and was a huge Denver Broncos fan and worked for almost 40 years at Mercy Hospital. He is preceded by his parents, wife Judy, brother Pat West, nephews Pee Wee West, and Ron West, Jr. Great-nephew Adam West. Survivors include his daughters, Jamie Tuttle, husband Eric, Avoca, Iowa, Jennifer West, husband Scott Maurer of Archer, Iowa, Michelle West, husband Brandon Smith, Missouri Valley, Iowa, 8 grandchildren, Sydney, Michael Kelly, Julia Lynch, Elix Hardy, Xavier Anderson, Josie Pierce, Hunter Anderson, Rod Kelly III, Mason Johnson, 1 great-grandson, sister Teresa Bull, husband Rick, Honey Creek, brothers George West, Jr., wife Kathy, Crescent, Iowa, Ron West, wife Deb, Honey Creek, Iowa, Rick West, wife Nancy, Honey Creek, Iowa, sister-in-law Sue West, Honey Creek, Iowa, nieces and nephews. Visitation Saturday, 9:30 a.m. from 11 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m., followed by funeral service at 11 a.m. all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment, Branson Cemetery with military rites by the American Legion Post 337. Rosella May O'Neill, age 93, passed away December 19th at Risen Sun. Rosella was born October 28, 1927, in Council Bluffs to the late Glenn and Maud Seeley and graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School. She was united in marriage to Richard O'Neill and sons Dallas and Douglas were born. Rosella worked many years at Iowa School for the Deaf as an overnight house parent, dietitian, and was very active in the deaf community. She is preceded in death by her husband Richard in 1996 and son Douglas in 2010. Rosella is served by son Dallas and wife Linda, six grandchildren, Rick O'Neill, Skylar, wife Michelle O'Neill, Jessica O'Neill, Douglas, wife Amanda O'Neill, Amanda, husband Josh Carroll, Thomas, wife Cheyenne O'Neill, 14 great-grandchildren, open visitation Wednesday, 12 noon to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Please adhere to social distancing and wearing of masks. Private family graveside services will be held. Next obituary, Dorothy M. Gardner, age 83, of Council Bluffs, passed away at her home on December 19th. Dorothy was born July 15, 1937, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to the late Claude and Catherine Fleury. She married James I. Gardner, Sr. on January 13, 1963, in San Diego, California. They were blessed with eight children. Dorothy worked at Equipment Brokers, Incorporated in Audubon, Iowa, and hostess and waitress at the Blue Ox and Village Inn restaurants, retiring in 2012. She was of the Catholic faith. In addition to her parents, Dorothy is preceded in death by her husband, James Gardner, Sr., in 2005, daughter Jacqueline, son Joseph, one sister and five brothers. Dorothy is survived by her children, Claudia Tootie, husband Mike Koenig, Louis, wife Sharon Gardner, Anna Gardner, Robert, wife Melanie Gardner, Dorothy Dottie, husband Joe Cable, James Gardner Jr., and 18 grandchildren, 26 great-grandchildren, 3 great-great-grandchildren, brothers Dennis, wife Dawn Fleury, Lawrence Fleury Sr., Dorothy's pets, dogs Tinkerbell and Buddy Cat, Jackie, and other relatives and friends. Visitation with the family Wednesday, 6 to 9 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Saturday, 1 p.m. at the funeral home. Interment Memorial Park Cemetery. Family will direct memorials. Sports. Logan Magnolia wins WIC Wrestling. Underwood places third. Underwood High School played host to this year's Western Iowa Conference Tournament, where Logan Magnolia claimed the WIC Team Championship, edging out Missouri Valley by 7 points. Underwood placed third as a team, and Trainer and Riverside capped off the top five in that order. Below is the full listing of team results and individual placings in order of lightest to heaviest weight class. Team results: Logan Magnolia, 210 points. 210 points. Missouri Valley, 203 points. Underwood, 152 points. Trainer, 144 points. Riverside, 135 points. AHSTW, 121 points. Tri-Center, 78 points. Audubon, 48 points. 106 pounds, first place. Eli Becerra, Missouri Valley, second place. Jacob Downey, Logan Magnolia, third place. Aiden Sengenemi, trainer, fourth place. Dalton Smith, Riverside, Fifth place, Clayton Johnson, AHSW. First place match, Eli Becerra, Missouri Valley, 16-0, FR, over Jacob Downey, Logan Magnolia, 11-4, Junior, Fall, 22.38. Third place match, Aiden Singmani, trainer, 12-8, senior, over Dalton Smith, Riverside, 7-7, freshman, MD, 15-6. Fifth place match, Clayton Johnson, AHSTW, 3-4, freshman, over By. 113 pounds, first place, Eli Collins, AHSTW, second place, Tarek Rowe, Logan Magnolia, third place, Brad Ortner, Missouri Valley. 120 pounds, first place, Jace Rose, Riverside, second place, Blake Allen, Underwood, third place, Riley Radke, Missouri Valley, fourth place, David Johnson, AHSTW, fifth place, Zeke Conkler, Audubon, sixth place, Gavin Keeger, Logan Magnolia. 126 pound first place, Stevie Barnes, Underwood. Second place, Sean Thompson, Logan Magnolia. Third place, John Schroeder, Riverside. Fourth place, Xavier Travato, Missouri Valley. Fifth place, Logan Marr, trainer. Sixth place, Manny Besswinger, Audubon. 132 pounds, first place, Hagen Highstand, Logan Magnolia, second place, Weston Allen, Underwood, third place, Andrew Bowman, Missouri Valley, fourth place, Hayden Fisher, AHSTW, fifth place, Ethan Flaherty, Tri-Center, sixth place, Jonas Keay, trainer. 138 pounds, first place, Fred Veach, Missouri Valley. Second place, Danny Kinsella, trainer. Third place, Nick Stevens, Underwood. Fourth place, Brady Thompson, Logan Magnolia. Fifth place, Dayton Moretti, AHSTW. Sixth place, Caden Please. 145 pounds, first place, Wyatt Reyes, Logan Magnolia. Second place, Eric McElhaney, Missouri Valley. Third place, Duncan Clark, trainer. Fourth place, Caden Fleek, Underwood. Fifth place, Jason Van Nordstrand, Tri-Center. Sixth place, Isaac Stamp, AHSTW. 152 pounds, first place, Brian Reese, Logan Magnolia. Second place, Carson Burhenny, trainer. Third place, Ben Hansen, Missouri Valley. Fourth place, Aiden Martin, AHSTW. Fifth place, Tanner Nelson, Tri-Center. 160 pounds, first place, Gavin McGuire, Logan Magnolia. Second place, Garrison Gettler, AHSTW. Third place, Jacob Pote, trainer. Fourth place, Rhett Bentley, Riverside. Fifth place, Owen Town, Missouri Valley. Sixth place, Ethan Chmelka, Tri-Center. 170 pounds, first place, Gage Clausen, Missouri Valley. Second place, Ethan Reichs, Riverside. Third place, Denver Pauly, AHSTW. Fourth place, Jordan Kerger, Logan Magnolia. Fifth place, Graham Jensen, Underwood. Sixth place, Levi Trainer. 182 pounds. First place, Brecken Freeberg, Tri-Center. Second place, Javelin Blant, Audubon. Third place, Carter Davis, Underwood. Fourth place, Caden Hendricks, Riverside. Fifth place, Breck Boroff, Missouri Valley. Sixth place, Logan Young, Trainer. 195 pounds, first place, Corey Coleman, trainer. Second place, Cooper Nielsen, Audubon. Third place, Joe Hedger, Logan Magnolia. Fourth place, Brock Comstock, Riverside. Shane Sinclair, Missouri Valley. Sixth place, Nate Jorgensen, AHSTW. 220 pounds. First place, Chris Gardner Underwood. Second place, Eddie Vlasic, Riverside. Third place, Daniel Gregory Trainer. Fourth place, Quinton Martin, AHSTW. Fifth place, Tristan Wortman, Tri-Center. Sixth place, Caden Bonham, Missouri Valley. 285 pounds. First place, Rex Johnson, Logan Magnolia. Second place, Connor Murray, Missouri Valley. Third place, Alex Ottesmore, Tri-Center. Fourth place, Easton Elledge, Underwood. Fifth place, Nathan Messerschmidt, Riverside. Sixth place, Jacob Madsen, AHSTW. Paul Sullivan. A college football season like no other includes the usual suspects in the playoffs and the Rose Bowl in Texas. The Big Four made it to the Final Four of the college football season as expected, ending one chapter of the most contentious, controversial, and unpredictable years in the history of the sport. The College Football Playoff Selection Committee avoided chaos Sunday, pitting number 1 Alabama against number 4 Notre Dame in one semifinal game and number 2 Clemson versus number 3 Ohio State in the other. The Clemson-Ohio State game will be played the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans with Alabama-Notre Dame in the Rose by the other name Bowl in Arlington, Texas. Let the bickering begin. Texas A&M fans will be expected to gripe loudly, and unbeaten Cincinnati will no doubt complain of being victimized by the Power 5 favoritism. But in reality, the four playoff teams have everything you need to cure a New Year's Day hangover, including Heisman Trophy candidates Mac Jones and Devonta Smith of Alabama, and quarterback Trevor Lawrence of Clemson, a strong but untested Ohio State team that played only 6 games, and Notre Dame, the school you either love or hate. "Our body of work was outstanding," said Notre Dame coach Brian Kelly, shrugging off the blowout by Clemson in the ACC title game. Bowl season begins Monday afternoon with the Myrtle Beach Bowl pitting Appalachian State against North Texas and concludes January 11th in Hard Rock Stadium in Miami with the SFP Championship game. It's a smaller field and an even more condensed bowl schedule than in recent years, and it will lack the pizzazz usually associated with much-anticipated events like the Cheez-It Bowl. No matter. At this point of the season, we're all used to postponements and cancellations, empty stadiums, abrupt rule changes, and the 2020 mantra, due to an abundance of caution, so anything goes. Due to COVID-19, 20 bowl games already have been canceled, including the inaugural LA Bowl in Inglewood, California. 3 others, including the venerable Rose Bowl, the site of one of the 2 semifinal games, have been moved to other cities. The granddaddy of them all decided to move the semifinal game from the namesake stadium in Pasadena to AT&T Stadium near Dallas late Saturday night after failing to convince government officials to relax COVID-19 restrictions in a hot zone and allow fans inside. Whether it will still be called the Rose Bowl is up to the city of Pasadena, but a Rose Bowl by any other name will still smell as sweet thanks to the money it generates for ESPN, the CFP, and the playoff teams. Perhaps a virtual sunset over San Gabriel Mountains can be displayed on the ginormous video boards at AT&T Stadium to appease the traditionalist. Kelly was among those calling for the switch of venues, and he got his wish. The Notre Dame coach complained Friday about the possibility of the Rose Bowl worshiping the ashes of tradition by possibly staying in Pasadena, and threatened to opt out of playoffs if players' families couldn't be in attendance. This, of course, came from an employee of a university whose president, Reverend John Jenkins, contracted COVID-19 after attending a super spreader event at the White House Rose Garden for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. California officials held their ground for the welfare of all the state's residents, including the granddaddies and grandmas of them all, whose health and safety were deemed more important than a college football game. Kudos to them. Kelly told ESPN Sunday he loves the Rose Bowl, and it wasn't really about the fans. We're grateful for the Rose Bowl to make that said. I know it was difficult. There are a lot of things that go along. There's television, and just really grateful that everyone was able to sit down and think of this makes sense. Kelly didn't mention the pandemic that ultimately led to the decision to change the site. Either way, more fans will now be able to watch the Irish in Texas thanks to Alabama's presence. We know there's going to be 16,000 fans able to watch in Arlington and 3,000 fans able to watch the game in New Orleans, said Selection Committee Chairman Gary Barta on the ESPN Selection Show. The committee decided there is an advantage for the number one seed by having more fans on hand. In truth, most of these bowl games shouldn't even be played, and several schools have already opted out of. But since the show must go on for the sake of TV, we're bound by tradition to tune in for more meaningless games than we could care to admit. New plane to enhance learning at in Iowa Western Aviation Maintenance Program. As the newest addition to Iowa Western's Community College Aviation Technology Department fleet of airplanes taxied to its new home, a group of students excitedly watched before jumping into action to get the bird in the college's hangar. Robert Falk, an Omaha physician, donated his 1981 Piper Cheyenne 2XL on Thursday, giving the program its newest, nicest plane to help enhance students' work as they prepare for careers in the field. "I'm hopeful it will benefit the community," Falk said at the department's home at the Council Bluffs Municipal Airport. The jubilation wasn't exclusive to students either. "It's an exciting day," aviation maintenance instructor Dylan Driscoll said. "This makes a huge difference. This is perfect." Falk, who's been flying since 1985, owned the Piper Cheyenne for the last 5 years. He said finding parts was becoming more difficult and decided it was time to do something for the plane. That something was a new home that'll help students advance their career prospects. The Iowa Western program teaches students all aspects of an aircraft: engines, instruments, flight physics, maintenance rules and regulations, heating and cooling, electricity, metal fatigue and corrosion, propellers, and a slew of other aspects, aviation maintenance instructor Eric Eli said. "It gives us a whole other plane to explore," Eli said of the gift. Driscoll noted that while the 1981 model sounds old, it's not like a used car. Planes must pass certification each year to remain in use. The Iowa Western program has a number of planes of various conditions, along with replica teaching tools. The instructors said they're thrilled to have another airworthy plane, this one a twin turbo engine, the real deal. "The real thing is always better," Driscoll said. "We can use this for 20 or 30 subject areas. Once students start working on it, the plane can't be flown, per Federal Aviation administration rules. It could fly again if purchased from the school, with the new owner having to get inspected and certified for flight. We'll keep it flight-worthy as much as we can, but this is a training facility. Mistakes will be made, which is expected, Eli said. They make mistakes here so they don't make them in the field. The Iowa Western program is the largest in the region. There are also programs in Indian Hills Community College at Indianola and Western Nebraska Community College in Sydney, Nebraska, along with an Aviation Institute of Maintenance in Kansas City, Missouri. Something new, something we didn't have before, second-year student Kane Smith said Thursday. Smith was among a group of students that came for arrival, though they didn't have to be there. Iowa Western's on winter break until January 11th. It's new and exciting, Smith said. It's very generous of the folks. Learn more about the Iowa Western Aviation Technology Program at iwcc.edu. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.